In the world of Tahereh Mafi's Reveal Me, a novel that has captivated millions and sparked countless TikTok theories, we find ourselves in the aftermath of Revolution. This fourth installment in the Shatter Me series has become a cultural touchstone for young adult readers worldwide, with celebrities like Taylor Swift reportedly naming it among her favorite dystopian series. What makes this particular book fascinating is how it shifts perspective to Kenji Kishimoto, the beloved, wisecracking secondary character whose voice offers a raw, unfiltered window into this fractured world. As the series has evolved from a straightforward dystopian romance into a complex political thriller with superhuman elements, Reveal Me stands as the turning point where personal trauma and global conflict become inseparable. The novel's exploration of trust, power, and human connection continues to resonate with readers seeking stories that balance emotional depth with high-stakes action. The cake sits before me, gradually disintegrating under the repetitive stabs of my fork. I've never lost my appetite before, but tonight, in this half-empty dining tent of the sanctuary, I can't bring myself to eat. The pristine whitewashed wooden beams and cream-colored canvas surrounding me feel almost obscenely clean compared to what we had at Omega Point. Around me, people are pairing off, disappearing into the night with smiles of relief and celebration. Lily and Ian, Brendan and Winston, Sonia and Sarah, Nuria and Sam, Castle trailing behind them. Everyone seems content, hopeful even, celebrating mere survival, while I'm left here with a knot of tension gathering between my shoulders, a dull pain spreading across my back. Why am I the only one concerned about Adam and James? Why does no one else seem worried that they're missing? Everyone dismisses my concerns with casual remarks like, "Adam made his decision," but they're forgetting crucial context. Adam pitched his immunity idea before we knew Anderson was still alive, before we heard about Anderson's plans. Adam would never willingly put James anywhere near that monster. This I know with absolute certainty. When Nazira sits beside me, my body betrays me with that familiar electric heat. She notices my mutilated cake and asks what's wrong. I can't help laughing when she uses my fork and reacts with mortification upon learning it was in my mouth, as if we haven't already kissed. Across the room, Juliet focuses entirely on Warner, and though I want to talk to her about Adam and James, Castle made me promise to leave them alone tonight. No one ever gives me an uninterrupted night to recover. No one really seems to care about my emotional state. No one but Jay. Walking away from the celebration, Nazira follows me down the dimly lit path. Her question still rings in my ears. You're in love with her, aren't you? The accusation that I have feelings for Juliet feels like salt in an open wound. I'm too exhausted for this conversation, too worried about Adam and James to engage with her jealousy. I am not in love with her, I say firmly, continuing toward my tent. Our argument escalates quickly, old wounds reopening as we rehash her betrayal, Anderson showing up ready to murder us because she revealed our location, Delalio's death, the way she bound, gagged, and drugged me onto a plane. Her defense comes swift and fierce. I did what I did to save your life. You have no idea what I risked. Standing in the lantern light, her beauty terrifies me. I remember her arms around my neck, her hands in my hair, pinning me against the wall, a memory so powerful it knocks the air from my lungs. But the trust between us has been shattered. You fly solo, Nazira, I tell her. You live by a moral code I don't understand. You're unpredictable. I have no idea what your real motivations are. I can't trust you. She warns me about speaking so boldly to someone I claim not to trust, but I call her bluff. If you were going to kill me, you'd have done it a long time ago. Our argument reaches its breaking point when I accuse her of being a machine, emotionless and calculating. The hurt that flashes across her face is unmistakable before her mask slips back into place. I kissed you, she says coldly. Did you think I was a machine then, too? In my confusion and desperation, words tumble out before I can stop them. "Jesus Christ, woman, I look at you like I'm in love with you." The admission hangs between us, unexpected and raw. Unable to face the implications, I retreat to my room, leaving her standing alone in the moonlight. Back in my room, grief crashes over me like a tidal wave, each wave bringing fresh anguish. I'm suddenly overwhelmed by longing for my mother, her comfort, her humor, her gentle touch through my hair. The memories surface with painful clarity. Her laughter as she cooked dinner, the way she'd sing while folding laundry, how she'd stroke my forehead when I was sick. I remember the scent of her favorite jasmine lotion, the sound of her humming old lullabies, the warmth of her hugs that made everything feel manageable. The pain of missing her threatens to drown me completely, leaving me gasping for air in a room that suddenly feels too small, too empty. Everyone around me seems to have found their people, while I've lost so many, a reality that cuts deeper with each passing day. Castle has his kid back, wrapped in the comfort of reunion, while my friends have partners who ground them in this chaos. But we've lost Adam, whose steady presence once anchored me, and James, whose innocence reminded us what we were fighting for. The halls of Omega Point echo with the absence of countless others who once filled these spaces with life. This profound loneliness feels like a physical weight pressing down on my chest, making it difficult to breathe. Each familiar face I see only reminds me of those I'll never see again. I force myself into the shower, turning the water as hot as I can stand it, hoping the scalding stream might somehow restore some sense of normalcy. Steam fills the bathroom, creating a temporary cocoon that shields me from reality, but even this small comfort proves fleeting. The mirror reveals dark circles under my eyes, and my reflection looks like a stranger, hollow-eyed and haunted. Despite my bone-deep exhaustion, sleep remains elusive as dawn approaches, my mind racing with memories and regrets. The ceiling becomes a canvas for my projected fears as I toss and turn. Just as consciousness begins to slip away, violent knocking at my door jolts me back to reality, the sound like gunshots in the quiet hallway. My heart leaps into my throat, already anticipating bad news. We've had too much of it lately to expect anything else. Brendan stands there looking worried, his usually confident demeanor shaken, refusing to explain what's happening. His hands fidget nervously, and he can't quite meet my eyes. "You need to hear it directly from Castle," he insists, the tension palpable as he leads me away. His reluctance to speak only intensifies my dread. Whatever has happened must be catastrophic. The early morning silence in the corridors feels oppressive, broken only by our hurried footsteps and my racing thoughts. When I burst into headquarters, my heart pounding against my ribs, Castle confirms my worst fears. Adam and James have been taken hostage by Anderson. The fluorescent lights cast harsh shadows across his usually composed face as he delivers the news. I resist accepting this reality, desperately arguing that Anderson wouldn't harm a child. But Winston quietly confirms he would, his eyes haunted by memories of Anderson's past brutality. The situation is even worse than I initially thought. Anderson has captured all the children of the Supreme Commanders, not just Adam and James. He's gathered them like precious chess pieces, each one a bargaining chip in his twisted game. My fury erupts when I discover Nuria and Sam knew about this 14 hours ago, but kept it from everyone, including Castle. The revelation hits like a physical blow, made worse by watching them exchange guilty glances across the conference table. Their justification, verifying the information before spreading potentially false news, feels like a hollow excuse for wasting precious time. The weight of those lost hours settles heavily in my chest as I imagine what the children might be enduring. Sam reveals she used her ability to see across vast distances to confirm the hostages in Sector 45, providing evidence to support Anderson's claims. Her gift, usually so reliable, had shown her glimpses of frightened children huddled in dark spaces, their faces illuminated by the harsh artificial lighting of underground bunkers. I focused on Sector 45 because Anderson would likely return to his power base in North America, Sam explains, her fingers nervously tracing patterns on the steel table. After Evie's death, he needs to maintain control, and that's where his strongest support remains. The compound there has extensive underground facilities, perfect for hiding hostages. The knowledge that my suspicions were correct brings no satisfaction, only a desperate need to act. Adam and James are in danger, and every moment we delay puts them at greater risk. I can almost feel time slipping away like sand through my fingers. The room dissolves into arguments about next steps, voices rising and falling as various strategies are proposed and rejected. Military leaders advocate for a direct assault, while intelligence officers push for a more subtle approach. But I've already made my decision, even as the chaos of competing voices swirls around me. There's only one person who truly understands what we're up against. Someone who knows Anderson's methods, his weaknesses, and the dark corners of his mind where his true motivations hide. Dawn finds me at Warner and Juliet's door, my trembling finger repeatedly pressing the doorbell in a state of complete panic. My heart pounds so hard I can barely breathe, and through the thick wooden door I hear Warner's irritated voice telling Juliet to ignore the intrusion. She insists on answering, her gentle voice carrying through the barrier between us. When Warner finally yanks open the door, he's furious and disheveled in his black silk bathrobe, his usually perfect blonde hair mussed from sleep. "This isn't about you," I try to explain, my voice cracking with desperation. "Juliet was my friend first, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't an emergency." The words tumble out fast and frantic, my hands shaking as I speak. Warner's anger suddenly shifts to concern when he senses the waves of fear rolling off me, his empathy gift picking up every ounce of my terror. When Juliet appears behind him, fully dressed in her combat gear, her warm smile quickly fades as she immediately recognizes something is terribly wrong. I can barely hold myself together, my chest tight with panic as I deliver the devastating news. Anderson took James and Adam. He's holding them hostage somewhere in Sector 45. The transformation in Warner's face is immediate and striking. Shock flashes across his features, followed by a cold, calculating fury I've rarely seen, even from him. His green eyes turn to ice, and his jaw clenches so hard I can see the muscle twitch. Despite our long-standing differences and complicated history, in this moment, we're united by a common enemy and a shared concern for James. Warner may be many things, ruthless, calculating, dangerous, but he understands Anderson's particular brand of cruelty better than anyone. And James isn't just Adam's brother, he's Warner's half-brother too, a fact that seems to hit him like a physical blow. Back in the war room with Juliet and Warner, I argue passionately that Warner's knowledge of the reestablishment and his father is invaluable to our rescue mission. If anyone knows what it's like to be tortured by Anderson as a child, it's Aaron, I tell Castle, challenging him for excluding Warner from these discussions. The room falls silent at my words, the weight of Warner's childhood trauma hanging heavy in the air. When Warner arrives with Nazira, Hyder, and Stefan, they walk with the perfect posture of super soldiers, their expensive tactical gear and pristine uniforms marking them as different from the rest of us in our worn resistance clothing. I feel a sharp pang of guilt remembering it's Warner's birthday today, another celebration interrupted by Anderson's calculated cruelty. The timing can't be coincidental. Anderson has always known exactly how to inflict maximum emotional damage on his son. As the meeting drags into its third hour, an overwhelming exhaustion crashes through my body. Not the normal fatigue from a long day, but something fundamentally and frighteningly wrong. My vision begins to swim, the fluorescent lights above blurring into hazy halos. The voices around the table grow distant and muffled, as if I'm underwater. My hands start trembling uncontrollably, and a cold sweat breaks out across my forehead. I try to stand, to signal for help, but my legs won't cooperate. The last thing I register before everything fades to black is Nazira's striking face, her dark eyes widening with alarm as I crumple to the floor. When consciousness slowly returns, I find myself lying on a makeshift medical cot, surrounded by a circle of worried faces. Sarah and Sonia, our resident healers, hover over me with professional concern as they explain my condition. The cocktail of sedatives Nazira used during the flight is still circulating in my system, they tell me, creating a dangerous combination with severe physical exhaustion and critical dehydration. An IV drips steadily into my arm, but they can't give me a clear timeline for recovery. It could be hours or even days before the drugs fully clear my system. Nazira stands slightly apart from the others, her arms crossed defensively as she justifies her earlier actions. She insists that drugging me on the plane was a necessary precaution, the only way to ensure Anderson wouldn't detect our presence and compromise the entire mission. Juliet challenges this sharply, arguing that I would have been a valuable asset rather than a liability. Her voice rises with barely contained anger as she points out my proven track record of loyalty and discretion. The twins exchange a meaningful look before stepping forward to reveal the full extent of my relationship with James to the group. They explain our years of friendship, the brotherhood we'd built, making it clear why the news of his capture had affected me so profoundly. Their words hang heavy in the air, adding another layer of gravity to an already tense situation. Despite the splitting headache and the weakness pervading every muscle, I manage to rasp out, "I'm fine," though it's clearly a lie. Castle immediately rushes to my side, relief evident in his features. I try to continue speaking, desperate to communicate my urgent concerns about James and Adam's situation, but exhaustion proves too powerful an adversary. My words slur and fade as consciousness slips away once more, pulling me back into darkness before I can share what they need to know. When I wake again, I'm alone in my room, the sterile medical equipment gone, except for the indent where the IV stand had been. The distant chirping of crickets filters through the window, a sound so foreign yet achingly familiar that it stops my breath for a moment. I haven't heard crickets since I was 14, back when the world still held some semblance of normalcy. Their song triggers memories of summer evenings and safety I thought I'd forgotten. Hunger claws at my insides with familiar intensity, a sharp, twisting sensation I remember all too well from my years on the streets. My muscles feel weak, trembling slightly as I push myself to sit up, but I force myself to focus on what I still have rather than what I've lost. I have shelter, real walls and a roof, not just cardboard and hope. I have clean clothes that fit, friends who risked everything to help me, and a makeshift family cobbled together from broken pieces. These thoughts steady me, but they can't drown out the urgent need to find James and Adam. Their absence feels like a physical wound. I'm gathering strength to shower, fingers fumbling with my shirt buttons, when instinct freezes me mid-motion. The air shifts imperceptibly. Someone's watching. Fear shoots through my veins like ice, quickly followed by white-hot anger. My hand finds my concealed weapon with practiced ease, but before I can fully grip it, my intruder moves with supernatural quickness. The gun disappears from my grasp as if it was never there. Desperation fuels creativity. I snap the leg off a nearby chair, splintered wood better than nothing. But my attacker anticipates this too. A boot connects with my back, sending me sprawling. When the door creaks open, adrenaline gives me the surge I need. I lunge for my displaced weapon, snatching it up and pursuing the shadow that slips into the forest. My legs shake with exhaustion, but years of survival training take over. I track them through the darkness, following subtle sounds, A twig snap here, disturbed leaves there. When I'm close enough, I gamble everything on one move, throwing my gun aside and launching myself forward. We hit the ground hard, and that's when her scent hits me. Jasmine and gunpowder. The fight drains from me instantly, replaced by confusion as she makes her confession. I was her first kiss. The words hang between us like visible things in the dark. I like you a lot, she says, her voice uncharacteristically vulnerable. She explains everything. The stronger sedative was protective, not malicious. Her presence in my room was concern, not threat. She stayed because she wanted to, despite everything she'd been taught about emotional distance. I've never learned how to handle these feelings, she admits. Relationships are too messy, too confusing. We're taught to avoid them entirely. She promises to maintain her distance and rises to leave, but I catch her arm. Why me? I ask about the kiss. Her answer cuts through all my defenses, leaving me completely exposed. Because I think you might be the best person I've ever met. Our moment of connection is shattered by a blood-curdling scream in the distance, a sound so primal and terrified it makes my skin crawl. Nazira and I race toward the source, her enhanced hearing picking up subtleties I can't detect. She stops periodically, head tilted like a predator tracking prey, before leading us back toward the entrance of Nuria's camp. Then more screams erupt, hundreds of them, a cacophony of terror that seems to come from everywhere at once. Beyond the sanctuary's protective boundary, we encounter a scene that defies comprehension. The sky above splinters like broken glass, fracturing between absolute darkness and blinding light. Deep fissures snake through the earth beneath our feet, the ground itself becoming unstable and treacherous. Most disturbing is the horizon. It writhes and shifts like a living thing, the sun performing impossible acrobatics as it plunges beneath us before violently swinging back into place. People stumble and fall, their minds unable to process the rapid shifts between day and night. Some cover their eyes, others reach out blindly for support that isn't there. We sprint back to warn the others, our hearts pounding, only to find the chaos has already reached them. The sight that greets us is haunting. Juliet kneels in the dirt, her body contorted in obvious agony, while Warner hovers beside her helplessly. The look of absolute terror on his face, someone who rarely shows any fear, sends ice through my veins. When Juliet screams, it's different from the others. Her cry isn't directed outward at the fracturing world, but inward, a desperate communication with someone beyond our perception. Emmeline, she cries out, her voice raw with desperation, please don't do this. The world continues to splinter around us, reality bending like paper in a flame. The air itself feels wrong, thicker in some places, thin as vacuum in others. Trees bend at impossible angles, their shadows pointing in multiple directions at once. This goes far beyond Anderson's hostage situation. This is something unprecedented, something that threatens the fundamental laws that govern our existence. The ground beneath us ripples like water, and in the distance, mountains seem to float and rotate in defiance of gravity. As I watch the sky tear itself apart above us, ribbons of darkness weaving through streams of brilliant light, I understand that everything we thought we knew about our fight has changed. Our previous battles, our political struggles, our personal vendettas all seem absurdly small in the face of this cosmic disruption. The true battle for our world's future is unfolding before us, with forces beyond our comprehension rending the very fabric of reality. At the center of this impossible maelstrom stands Juliet, or Ella, as we now know her, somehow connected to these reality-bending powers we've only begun to understand. Her connection to Emmeline, whatever it might be, seems to be the key to this chaos, though whether she's trying to prevent it or is somehow causing it remains unclear. The rules of our world are being rewritten before our eyes, and we're all just characters caught in the rewrite.